Okay.
I got everybody's paper up here.
Today I wanted to sort of tie up some loose ends that I haven't been talking about. Namely, I want to tell you the facts about the Riemann integral. But I'm not going to demonstrate these facts. They're kind of the type of thing I learned in somewhere. I guess I took a class at Michigan, sort of an advanced calculus class where we did the Riemann integral, and the guy was a very famous mathematician named Jussi Weisselov, Finnish guy, and so he just went and did the whole book. And this is the kind of thing that appears at the end of Walter Rudin's nice little book called Principles of Mathematical Analysis. It's on page 322 of Rudin. So that's the little fact I'm going to tell you about. And he actually proves it. The question is, well, which functions are Riemann integrable? And it turns out to be, there's a simple answer, it's just kind of a mind-blowing answer. So remember the Riemann integral, you've got this function. And it's, so let's say we're going from A to B. And then here's the function. Remember the Riemann integral, you take lower sums, which would be the nth on each interval. So I cut the thing into intervals. And I would take the lower sum would be that you'd take the nth on each interval and calculate the area of these rectangles. That would give you a lower sum. Then you would also take, so you get a lower sum L. That would give you an underestimate of the area under that curve. And then the overestimate, you take the soup on each interval, and that would give you an overestimate. And you do that over all partitions, and you'll see that as you refine your partitions, the lower sums go up, and the upper sums go down. And when a function is Riemann integrable, those sums go to something, which is the integral. So the deal is, you'd have lower sums, which involve the inf on those intervals, less than or equal to the integral from A to B, the actual area, is less than or equal to the upper sums. And when something is Riemann integral, as you refine the partition, these upper sums go down as a decreasing sequence, and these go up, and they meet in the limit. That's the definition of Riemann integral. So a function is Riemann integrable means that the lower sums go up to the integral, and the upper sums go down. If there's a gap between those limits, of course, then the thing's not Riemann integrable. So to make these things make sense, you need a function that's bounded. Otherwise, those soups and ints don't make any sense at all. So the big fact is, like I said, I got to define something. I got to define a set of measure zero. So definition. A set S in the real line is a set of measure zero. This is Lebesgue measure, the real thing. If given epsilon bigger than zero, any epsilon bigger than zero, I can find a bunch of little open intervals that cover S where the total length of those intervals is less than epsilon. So here it is. There exists a sequence of open intervals let's say AN to BN. So these are non-empty. AN is less than BN. Such that S is covered by those intervals. So S would be contained in the union over N, say from 1 to infinity, of those open intervals. But the total length of those intervals is less than epsilon. Such that the length of those intervals would be the summation of bn minus an is less than epsilon. That's the definition of set of measure zero. Questions about that? So the set of rational numbers in the real line is a set of measure zero. So here's an example. The countable set is always a measure zero. So let's say the x in 0, 1 that are rational. So let's see, the rational numbers are q, is a set of measure zero. Question? Let's see, the reason for that is that's a countable set. So you can let Rn be an enumeration of them. So they're countable. Everybody is familiar with countable sets from someplace in a math class, I hope. It means you can put them in one-to-one correspondence with the positive integers. So you can list out the rational numbers as a list, 1, 2, 3, and number them. Even though they go back and forth all over the place, you can still number them. So that's an enumeration of them. And let's let epsilon be bigger than zero. How can I find a set of size epsilon that covers all those? Any big ideas?
Does it focus on, because they're countables, have one open interval focus on each of the rational numbers?
Yeah, how big should I make that open interval be?
I mean, it should be a geometric sequence.
Yeah, that's a great idea. So if I put, for each one of those, I would stick them in. Why don't I make this, I could make it an open interval, because 0 and 1 I don't really care about, because then I have to do something, 0 and 1 aren't so special. So I'll make this thing an open interval instead of a closed interval. That way I won't have to deal with the endpoints. So his idea is the one I want. I would put an interval, so make an interval for each Rn. Rn would be contained in interval In and I would make the diameter of IN, so maybe I'd make the diameter epsilon over 2 to the n. In fact, I can make it less than epsilon over 2 to the n, especially if it's near one of the endpoints. So if it's really close to an endpoint, I might have to shrink my diameter. But the more I shrink it, the better. But epsilon over 2 to the n is a if epsilon is small, this is really small, and gets smaller and smaller with n, and the sum of that series is 1. 2 to the n is 1. So and so the aha is the sum of epsilon over 2 to the n as I go from 1 to infinity is epsilon. That's a geometric series. So even though they get smaller and smaller, their total area, their total length couldn't be more than epsilon. So it's kind of mind-blowing. You know, the rational numbers are dense, and each one of these is contained in an open blob. It's hard to imagine real numbers that aren't in there. You know what I mean? But there's lots of them, because this sums up to a set of measure epsilon, and the measure of the interval is 1. So there's 1 minus epsilon measure of things that don't get in this set, even though it looks like we're just plastering little open segments all over the place. That's kind of freaky. So when you start thinking about these things, you're thinking about sort of measure theoretic interesting questions. And they get very interesting very fast. Okay, so that's the definition of a set of measure zero. A very cool thing to do is to find yourself a set of measure zero that's uncountable. The famous Cantor's middle third set is such a thing. It's uncountable. Every point of it is a limit point of it, and it has measure zero. It's a really fascinating thing to do. Have people seen that in a real analysis class? Yeah, that's cool. And I don't want to get into many of the subtleties here, but I want you to be aware of the words. So, the big fact, the big theorem that I was alluding to, F is Riemann integrable. If and only if one, F has to be bounded. Let's see, Riemann integral on AB. F is bounded on AB, so the Riemann integral makes sense. You can write it. And it's continuous almost everywhere. So let's see. Almost everywhere means everywhere but a set of measure zero. F is continuous almost everywhere. On AB. Meaning everywhere but on a possible set of measure zero. Minus a possible set of measure zero. Of course, it could be empty. That's what almost everywhere means. So that's a famous theorem. And you know the basic facts to be able to prove it. It just takes some pages and some cleverness to go through. And if you want to see a proof, pull out Walter Rudin's Principles of Mathematical Analysis and look at page 322. And so I was going to bring in I have a copy of Antoni Zygmund's trigonometric series book. It's a great big thick thing, and it's this big, and it's got just gobs and gobs of stuff in it. All the theorems in there are exactly why people had to invent measure theory. because there's so many subtle, weird things that Fourier series do. And you saw some of the difficulties in the homework where you had to cook up this function that did weird things, like going to zero in integral, but not going to zero as a function. That kind of stuff is annoying, and it's one of the subtleties that arises in Fourier series. Another fact that I'll mention, that if f is Riemann integrable, that Riemann integral is equal to its Lebesgue integral. If f is Riemann integrable, so when Riemann integrals make sense, you can then the Lebesgue theory still works, and so you might as well use the Lebesgue theory and forget you ever saw the Riemann integral someday. Not today yet, though. If f is Riemann integrable, then some books write this for the Riemann integral equals the Lebesgue integral. So I'm using this for the and this one's the Riemann integral. That's nice to know. You might have noticed that I skipped over something in the book. And I think I should go back and talk about it today. It's kind of a fun thing to understand. It was a section on uniqueness of Fourier series. And I think Stein wanted to do it quick and early because he wanted you to get used to the idea of these kernels, which were nice. They had a big spike in the middle, and the rest of their integral was small. So I think that was his way of introducing the concepts of the Fayer kernel. But I went straight to the Fayer kernel without doing this. So this subject is called uniqueness of Fourier series. You want to say that if something has zero Fourier series, then it's zero. And that's kind of almost true. But then there's function, like a function that's one on the rational numbers and zero everywhere else, that has Lebesgue integral zero. But it doesn't have a Riemann integral. So it's a hard thing. If you're going to talk about Riemann integrable functions, you run into difficulties. And so if an integral is zero, you want to say the function is zero. In Lebesgue theory, you can say, well, it's zero, except for maybe a set of measure zero, where it's not zero. So there's things like that that have to be talked about, that I couldn't talk about because I hadn't defined sets of measure zero. So the fact I want to show is that, let's suppose if f is piecewise continuous, and all the Fourier coefficients are zero. Then f is the zero function. So that's the uniqueness part of Fourier series. And the reason I didn't use Stein's proof for this is because I prove Parseval's identity for these functions. So we can see this by Parseval's. If all the Fourier series, so I could prove this for you today. Here's the proof. I showed you last time that Parseval's holds for this. So 1 over 2 pi integral from minus pi to pi of f squared dx would be the sum of those squares. If they're all zero, this side's zero, and so I have a piecewise continuous function whose integral is zero. And that makes, in this category of being piecewise continuous, that would force f to be 0 on all those intervals. So if the Fourier series is a big fat 0, I get 0 over here. And in this category of functions, namely ones that are piecewise continuous, having a 0 integral forces f to be 0.
So the fact is, for piecewise continuous, functions, integral of f squared equals 0 implies the function is 0. So check,
it's true. Okay. But Stein proves this for a more general category.
So Stein's theorem that you'll find, let's suppose f is Riemann integrable. Which means it would be bounded
and continuous everywhere except on a set of measure 0.
And let's suppose that all the Fourier coefficients are equal to 0.
Well, then I don't have Parseval's identity yet. Pretend I do have it, but pretend I don't have it. I certainly don't have it for this category of function.
So the conclusion here is, then, f has to be identically 0 on any interval where it's continuous.
So that's almost as good as being identically 0. Where the thing is continuous, it's got to be 0. And in the weird small set where it's not continuous, well, you'll know. So here's the very clever thing that you'll find in the book.
So what did he do? He took, let's look at the cosine function.
I want to cook up trig functions that spike at the origin.
Okay, so the first one to take is the cosine function. Let's see, at minus pi it's minus 1. So it goes like this. Oh, I'm sorry. Has a bump like that. Here's minus pi, here's plus pi. That's the cosine function.
And if I take powers, well, it's not going to do what I want it to do. What I want to take powers that are going to make it shrink every place except near the hump, the top of the hump here. And near the top of the hump, I want it to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So the brilliant idea is to add epsilon to that.
So if I add a little epsilon to that, that would just shift it up by epsilon. So this thing is epsilon plus cosine x.
And let's see, if epsilon is small, that would be bigger than 1 on a little tiny hump.
Let's see, here's where it's 1. So it would be bigger than 1 on this interval from here to here.
And it's less than 1 in absolute value on the rest. So if I started taking powers of this thing, where it's bigger than 1, it would get bigger and bigger. And where it's less than 1, it would get smaller and smaller.
So here's the brilliant idea.
And I could make that interval there as narrow as I like. If I took the epsilon really small, I could make that interval where that happens
really small. So this is like a minus delta to a plus delta. Plus delta. And by taking epsilon small, I can make that get small. Epsilon greater than 0 small, I can make the delta small. That's the place where it's bigger than 1. So that the function epsilon plus cosine x is bigger than 1 in minus delta to delta, and its absolute value is less than 1 outside of that. And now the brilliant idea is to take powers of that. That would make it go to 0 outside and make it get bigger and bigger inside that little range of, from minus delta to delta. So now, in fact, I'll take it to even powers. So let's take an fn of x to be equal to epsilon plus cosine x. I like it to be positive, what the heck. So I'll take it to the 2nth power. That's going to get bigger and bigger on the little delta spot and smaller outside. And I can make it go to 0. So the picture would be, I'd get a thing that's gigantic. It'd be really small, just positive. Let's see, is it going to have any zeros? I guess it could have some zeros, who cares? But then it gets gigantic. And it's small here. And I can squeeze that gigantic space into a little tiny thing. And so, here's an interesting thing. That's a trigonometric polynomial. I could expand that in terms of cosine nx. Anybody know how to do that? Cosine nx and sine nx. You've seen trig identities before, right? So you mean cosine to the 10th. You can expand in terms of sines and cosines to the 1x. How would we do that?
With double angle?
Yeah, but then I'd have to use quadruple angle, and there are formulas for all that stuff. If I wanted to think about it and kill them all with one hard slam, how would I do it? Yeah, that's the key. So here's why this stuff is called a trig polynomial. This thing is a trig poly. And here's why it's a trig poly. I would write it as fn of x is epsilon plus e to the I x plus e to the minus I x over 2 to the 2n. And then I'd use the binomial theorem to expand this, and I'd get a sum of powers of e to the I x and e to the minus I x. And when these two multiply each other, you know, the plus I cancels the minus I, and I get a constant. So this is going to be a sum of e to the inx cn's times that plus bn's times e to the minus inx out to 2n. Or I should maybe call these k's. I'd get an e to the ikx, e to the minus ikx. These are k's. As k goes from minus 2n to plus 2n. And so if something has all Fourier coefficients being 0, that would mean all the integrals, when you pair these with my original function, would have to be 0. So what we see, so that's a trig polynomial. So check. So, but f hat of n equals 0 for all f, for all n, implies that when I pair it with a trig polynomial, I get 0. So that would imply that f is orthogonal to all trig polynomials. So f would be orthogonal to this thing. So that would mean the integral from minus pi to pi of f of x times my fn of x dx equals 0. Well, I should have told you, I can always shift my function. So let's suppose it's continuous at x equals 0 on an interval. If f is continuous near the origin on an interval about the origin, about 0, then I would, here's what I would do. Let's suppose f is looking like this. Let's suppose it's not 0 there. Let's suppose it's not 0. And might as well assume it's positive. So we can assume that's positive. Otherwise, we'd take minus the function. F of 0 is positive. So if it's something up here, there's f of 0. If f was continuous in an interval, I could get make a little interval here where this is strictly positive. So let's see, what would I do? I would take half this value and use the definition of continuity and see that it has to stay above half that value. This would be f naught over 2. And f being continuous, I could take my delta so that this is strictly above that. And then I want my delta to be well inside this. So I'd get my delta here and my delta here. So I'd get, when I multiply this function by my thing with a great big spike, I would get something that integrates to positive. And the other stuff would integrate to something small, because it, outside this interval, it's nice and bounded, and going to 0, in fact. And that's how you get the contradiction. So you get the contradiction. We can see that the integral of f against fn dx from minus pi to pi would be strictly bigger than 0. Because when I integrate that gigantic thing, I get something big. And on the outside, I get something bounded. So when you add it up, you get big plus bounded, that would still be positive. For a big N. So that's kind of cool. And that was to get you ready for the Thayer's theorem. Any questions about that? I thought I'd take a break from Fourier series for a couple days now and go and start thinking a little bit about harmonic functions, because we have the tools to discover some pretty neat things about harmonic functions. What we did recently was solve the Dirichlet problem. So remember, the problem was, on the unit circle, we were given a continuous periodic function, f of theta, continuous and periodic on the boundary. on the circle. There's the circle. And then we got a harmonic function on the inside that was given by the Poisson integral formula, and that had the function f as boundary values. So u, remember it was u of r e to the I theta inside the unit disk, was 1 over 2 pi integral from minus pi to pi, or it could be 0 to 2 pi if you prefer. We had 1 minus r squared in the numerator, and in the denominator we had r e to the I theta minus e to the I psi, and then we multiply by f of psi d psi. That's the formula we got by summing up a Fourier series. And then after I did that formally, I was able to verify that it really works using the properties of a good kernel that this thing has. Okay. An important fact that this pops right out is that at the value at the center, it's the average of the function f of psi. So this is the origin. So remember, u is harmonic on the whole unit disk. Call that d10, and it's continuous up to the circle, and it has the right boundary values. So it extends continuously to C, and u of e to the I psi on the circle is f of psi. And here's an important thing to note. Let's look at u of zero. U at the origin is 1 over 2 pi integral from 0 to 2 pi. Let's see, when that would be r is equal to 0, so I get 1 minus 0 squared on the top. And r e to the I theta would be the center, and so I get 0 minus e to the I psi. That has modulus 1. F of psi d psi. The Poisson kernel is exactly 1 at the origin. And so this spits out that u is this simple thing, 1 over 2 pi integral from 0 to 2 pi f of psi d psi. That's the average of f over the circle. You can also think of it like this. It's the average also with respect to arc length. So let's see, I could write this as 1 over 2 pi, the radius. Oh, the radius is 1. So this is kind of dumb here. What I want to do is put 2 pi r, and I'll put an r here for r d psi. If that was a circle of radius r, that would be the length of the circle, and that would be the arc length of the circle. So it's the average with respect to arc length. Okay, so here's another. So the big fact is harmonic functions satisfy the averaging property. I could do the Poisson kernel for a non-unit disk, a disk of radius r, about any point. So harmonic functions satisfy the averaging property. Namely, that if I take a little z naught here. Here's a z naught. And let's say it's harmonic nearby on a little disk of radius r about here. Then u at z naught would be 1 over 2 pi. I think I'll use I like the complex notation. So I'll take the integral from 0 to 2 pi of u of a circle. So that would be z naught plus r e to the I psi d psi. Okay, so the same thing works if it's not a unit circle. You can always take that formula for the unit circle and shift it. Translate and stretch to get any circle. And translating and stretching preserves harmonic functions. So the formula for the unit disk gives it for any disk. And then now I think I can write that. Here's what I'll do. That's equal to 1 over 2 pi radius r, so that's the total length of the circle, and then if I put a 1 over r there, I'd have to put an r here. So this is 1 over the arc length of the circle, of the perimeter, and this is ds for arc length. So it's an average with respect to the arc length of the circle. And it turns out that that is a very unique property that harmonic functions have. I'm going to show you that if a continuous function has that property, it is harmonic. And that's kind of mind-blowing, because the Poisson formula shows that u has to be infinitely differentiable. So let's note that. You can differentiate under the Poisson formula. Under the Poisson integral. So harmonic functions are infinitely differentiable. That's nice to know. They're infinitely differentiable, meaning all their partial derivatives exist and are continuous. And it turns out that satisfying the averaging property is going to make something harmonic, and therefore it will be infinitely differentiable. So something that smooths out and averages things makes them really smooth in the sense of derivatives. Okay, to show you this thing, which is a classic result, I'm going to show you step one, which is that harmonic functions satisfy a maximum principle. Which means that the maximum always has to be assumed on the boundary. If a maximum happened in the interior of some place, it would have to be a constant function. So the maximum principle is, if f assumes a max, or let's call it, I'm calling my harmonic functions g, I'm sorry, u. If u assumes a max inside the disk of radius 1, I'll be on the unit disk. Then the thing would have to be identically constant. It means the harmonic functions are slippery. If you graph it, it has to have a slope everywhere. You can't have a little hump where you could sit. That's how I like to think about it. And so let's think about why. Let's see. Say u is max at the point z naught that's inside the unit disk. I'm assuming this thing is continuous up to the boundary, so I can use the Poisson integral formula. Or I could even assume it's harmonic in a bigger set. So here's my unit disk. And let's say here's my point Z naught. That's a max. And harmonic functions satisfy the averaging property. Okay, so if I do a circle here, like that.
Oh, blast. Am I kidding? Think about it. That means U would be its average over this green thing. And so I would have, if the function ever got less than its max, then on this green circle, this integral would be strictly smaller than that. So on this whole circle, on this whole green circle, it would always have to be M, the max. If it ever got less than that, that integral would be smaller than the value at the center. And I can shrink that circle and see that it's constantly equal to M on this whole circle. Okay, so it's constantly equal to M on this whole circle. Then I would have a spot here where it achieves its max. And I could do this circle. And I could paint the whole disk this way and see that it's always equal to M. So let's see, that circle would mean it would mean it's equal to M on this one. And because if I average on this circle, if it ever dipped below M, this integral would be less than M when I average. And so it can't dip below it. It has to always be M, the max. So let's call it a max M. And this, I'd make it smaller. I would see it has to be totally equal to M on this whole set. That's the max. Now it's, I would do it here and do circles here that do the same thing and see that they would have to spread out and I'd get the whole thing that way. There's better ways of doing it, figuring this out that don't use this painting trick. But now I would start over again at this spot and paint again. I do circles that get bigger and bigger. And in no time at all, I get to the middle. And when I get to the middle, I can paint the whole thing and see that it's constant M on the whole thing. I'll start out next time and be more careful about that. Did I get everybody's paper up here? Real analytic.
Yes.
That means it's a power series like that's a stronger condition.
Is it stronger condition?
Being equal to a convergent power series locally is stronger
than
being differential. Because real analytic functions are infinitely differential.
Oh, that's right, because you have a...
You can differentiate power series under over and over again.
Yeah, but you cannot...
But, for example, things like... Well, I can show you functions where, like... e to the minus 1 over t squared sine 1 over t that are infinitely smooth, but they're not equal to a power series.
They are.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, stuff like that.
Oh, this is change.
So if I would like to review this in grades, I should contact the teaching assistant.
If you, yeah, or you, I could serve as an intermediary.
Yeah, now I don't remember that.
I have the, he's put his email address on the homepage. You can email him and maybe, if you want me to give it back to him, you can email.
No, I can get email, send an email and try to get it back. Thank you.
Okay, if you have any trouble, let me know and I'll get involved.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
I had a question about the grading too.
Oh, really?